My wife comes home tomorrow. Those of you who have some sympathy have asked, and you've asked how I've done it, and the answer is, it's not that hard to be a mother, it's apparently. No, my mommy came to help me. That's how I did it. So that's the secret. Bring your mommy home with you. I want to begin to talk to you tonight on the subject of marriage here for a few weeks, and I don't really know how long we'll go. My suspicion is I'll just pull a Daryl Savine, and when I'm done, I'm done, you know, and that'll be it. Some of you know Brother Savine, who used to pastor here, and then he would start a subject, and he would call it quits pretty quick that week, you know, come to a dead stop. And so my suspicion is that's probably what I'll end up doing. Tonight, I want to talk to you, though, at least one night. I want to talk to people who are single and people who are thinking about dating. And I think that will also branch over into marriage. But I at least want to start at the beginning. You know, and this is an old statistic. They say that of adults, and I don't know what age they count adults, maybe I don't know if it's 18 or 21, but again, this is an old statistic that 40% of adults are single in America. I think people are getting older or married older. I think that's part of it, and there are reasons why people are waiting to get married, and some are logical, and maybe some are, you know, a little tendency to be concerned about being married, but that's why I think a church should never advertise themselves as a family church. You know, right there you throw out 40% of the population. We are a family. We are a church that's a family, and part of what we do is we build families, but it's a part of what we do. We do a lot of other things other than build families here. And so I want to talk again to singles tonight and talk to you about what you would be looking for if you're single and thinking about getting married. And then I think the connotation is for all of us, what should we be as married people, and what should we be where people would be find us easy to live with. And so let me say, first of all, that being single is okay. Christianity, again, is the only religion where the founder was single. That's Jesus Christ. Muhammad had wives. Buddha had wives. Confucius had a wife. Hinduism and Shintoism didn't have a founder. So the Christianity of the seven major world religions, Christianity is the only one where the founder is single. And he was perfect in every way. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1 says this, "Now concerning the things which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." And I don't think those are married men. I think he's making something very general statement, saying it's good if a man doesn't want to have a relationship with a woman. There's nothing wrong with being single. I have said in the past, and I think it's an error to say it, and others have said it as well, so I'm not the only one who's said it, that, you know, you look at Adam, and poor Adam, he was alone and he needed a helpmeet, and so there's Eve. Of course, she was the downfall, cost him his house, got thrown out of the garden, and it's all Eve. But Adam was a bystander to the whole thing. But it's easy to say, well, Adam was a lonely, pathetic creature, but he needed to be married. It's true, it's not good for man to be alone, but you have to understand also, Adam was completely alone. All he had was a snake to talk to. I don't know what he had to talk to. But it's also true that siblings, that friends, that even friends of the opposite sex, it's true that when you live in a society, that's quite different than the way Adam was living. And I think we have to admit that those relationships that we can have, those deep, lifelong relationships, can be extremely fulfilling and can really compensate for the loneliness that we might feel otherwise. And so, again, singleness is okay. Paul will exalt singleness when he says later on that he was single and that he would like for everybody to be like him. In verse 7 of 1 Corinthians 7, he says, I wish everyone was like me. He's saying, I'm single. And then later on, he says, in verses 32 and 34 of that chapter, he says, if you're single, you can give yourself more fully to the work of the Lord. He's saying that if you're married, you have less time to give to God. So in that sense, he wished that everybody had been single so that they would have more time to give to the work of the Lord. Now, he's giving singles a lot of credit, and he's assuming that a single would be less self-centered, and that's not always the case. He's assuming that if you were single, the time that you would give to maintaining your family, you would give to the Lord. And again, that's not maybe a given, but he's saying that in theory that would be the case, so that being single would be okay. In verse 7 there again, he says that singleness is a gift. He says, for I wish that all men were even as myself, but each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. So there he says, if you're married, it's a gift. But if you're single, it's a gift. And you ought to embrace the gift. If you're single, don't say, well, I wish that God would gift me. Thank you for the gift that you've given to me. I have less responsibility. I have potentially more time. I can be more irresponsible. I don't have to ask anybody how I spend my money. If I have any money, I have more capacity to work for the Lord. I have a simpler lifestyle. And all of that is a gift. Now, by the way, how do you know how do you know you have the gift of singleness? Being single is a gift, but how do you know you have the gift of singleness? Well, it's real simple there in chapter 7, again, of 1 Corinthians. He says, I wish that all men were as myself, but each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and the other in that. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it's good for them if they remain even as I, but if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry, because it's better to marry than to burn with passion. Yeah. That's how you know you don't have the gift of singleness, if you're single and burning with passion. See, I'm married with 4 kids. I mean, I don't have the gift of singleness. That's what that means. Never had the gift of singleness. But if you have the gift, embrace the gift. And if you say, well, I don't have the gift of singleness, but I'm single anyway, well, embrace this season of your life then as a gift. And so I think that's good Bible. Again, the issue is not whether you're single or married in Scripture. The issue is, and where the sin comes in, is if you're single and you're living like you're married. That's the rub. If you're single, live like a single person. Don't live like you're married. She's your girlfriend, she ain't your wife. You're still single. So don't live like you're married. Now the converse of that, that never gets touched on a lot in the church because it's touchy, but Paul will work on that in those first 10 chapters of 1 Corinthians 7, or the first 10 verses. He says it goes both ways. If you're single, don't act like you're married. But if you're married, don't act like you're single. And then he talks about how married people have duties to each other. And a lot of people in the church are married, but they're not fulfilling their duties. Paul says, it's as wrong if you're married to act like you're single as it is if you're single to act like you're married. And we beat up on the single people and say you shouldn't live like that because you're not married. But it goes both ways. There are married people that... listen, if you got married, you had duties. You're not fulfilling your duties. And so it goes both ways. So being single again is okay in Scripture, and Paul will spend a lot of time saying, don't put down the single people. If you're single, don't act like your life is somehow incomplete because you don't have a mate. Don't live like that. Embrace this season of your life as a gift, and perhaps you have the gift of singleness. You can say, listen, I'm single, and I honestly don't burn with passion. Well, then you're doubly gifted. You're single with the gift of singleness. And you ought to count yourself lucky and just enjoy sitting around counting your money. That's the way you live that. But being married is okay, too. Verse 2 there, 1 Corinthians 7 says, nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each wife have her own husband. So Jesus is single, Paul is single, but then the kickback is, so marriage is good. When he created marriage, it's part of the creation which he stands back and calls good. So marriage is good in and of itself. Now, I want to spend the rest of tonight then talking about if you're single and you would like to be married, according to Scripture, what should you be looking for in a mate? And then the kickback, what kind of person should you be? Did my mic go out? There it goes. I don't know, Pastor. Well, here I'm back, baby. Let's give it a go here. If not, I can do the handheld. I think one of the reasons people are staying single longer is because there's anxiety about getting married or about getting out of broken families. Or even if mom and dad stayed together, it wasn't a very good marriage. And I think people are getting married later in life because a lot of people are going to college and it's taking longer to get their careers going. And I think there's a financial... I do think people have anxiety about making that lifelong commitment. And if I can help ease that anxiety tonight, I'd like to. First of all, what are you looking for in a mate? And I think the number one thing is that you're looking for a person with similar values. Remember in Genesis chapter 24, Abraham is older and he wants Isaac to have a wife. And so he looks at all the women. Abraham had gone about 1,200 miles when he was 75 and had established himself in what we would think of as Israel today. But then Isaac's ready to get married, and Abraham says, you can't marry anybody around here. And so he sends a servant all the way back to the homeland to get a wife from the place that Isaac would have grown up. And I think one of the reasons he did that, religion of the local girls, but on top of that, I think that he said, Isaac needs a wife who understands him, that was part of his upbringing, that was part of his culture. I think that my son needs a wife with similar values. Susan Vogt wrote a lot of books, and she said she counseled over 5,000 married couples in her life. She's a therapist. She said, for the first 30 years of my profession, I would have said that the number one thing that makes a good marriage is communication skills. She said, now at this point in my life, I would say that it's similar values. You have to have similar values. Because the point is that if you are far apart in values, it doesn't matter how well you use I am statements. It doesn't matter how well you communicate if you're just that far. If he voted for Donald Trump and you voted for Hillary Clinton, it doesn't matter how well you tell them what you believe. It's not going to be helpful. Doesn't matter how well you communicate if you're that far off in values. And again, Susan Volk says, if one spouse values a simple lifestyle and the other values accumulating wealth, it doesn't matter how well they communicate. The basic life orientation will present constant opportunities for conflict. If one spouse values faith and the other one resents religion, conflict is inevitable. Another important common value is one's attitude towards having children. One partner may really want children and feel marriage would not be complete without a child, while the other is ambivalent or at worst thinks children would impinge upon their lifestyle. Good communication can only clarify the differences, not solve them. And so again, you say, well, you know, you might be looking at your husband and saying, you don't communicate well. Communicating is what you don't want to hear anyway. So you have to have a degree of common values. And by the way, that's the basis in Scripture of why a Christian should never marry a non-Christian. I think that's why Paul will say that there in, I think, 1 Corinthians 6, or 2 Corinthians 6, chapter 6 of one of those two books, about light and darkness being joined together, and he makes the implication there of married and unmarried being joined together. And that just makes perfect sense. You know, if you're a Christian and you say, well, you know, I'm a Christian, but I don't have any real issues with marrying somebody who's not a Christian, Christian faith doesn't govern my values. Because if you're a Christian, that has implications on how you spend your money. If you're a real Christian, has implications on how you manage your money, has implications on how you're going to raise your kids, has implications about what you watch, the kind of language that you use, where you want to go, has implications with how you're going to spend your weekends. And so if you say, well, you know, I'm a Christian, but you know, it doesn't matter if I marry in or out of the faith, all you're saying is that your Christianity really doesn't govern what you do. At best, you're a nominal believer in that sense. Because a believer and a non-believer have a completely different sense of what's important in life. I mean, and we've used this illustration before. If I'm a single parent and I have a child from a previous marriage, or maybe my wife's boat sunk, so it's a bad joke. Don't let the boat sink, whatever you do, Lord. So there I have my children. And again, I meet a person who I think I might want to marry, and they look at me and say, I love you, but I don't like your kid. That would be a deal breaker. What makes you think we would have a quality relationship for you to look at me and say, I love you, but I don't like your kid? Well, what's the difference in that? If Jesus is the most important thing in my life, how are you going to have a relationship if somebody looks at you and says, I like you, but I don't like your Savior? I don't like your God. Well, if I feel about Jesus the way I should, that's a deal breaker. Because I feel stronger about Jesus in theory than I should about my child. So again, you know, for a Christian, when you talk about the most important thing is that you have similar values, of course that implies that you ought to marry in the faith. And by the way, you need to know the difference in Christians and church people. There's a big difference in church boys and church girls and Christians. And you're in for a lot of pain if you haven't figured that out. How do you know a person that you're dating is a genuine Christian? Now, I mean, you could ask a lot of questions, But maybe the best question that you ought to ask is, when I'm around this person, is it easier or harder to serve God? Is this person a detriment to me serving God? Because if I'm around this person, doggone it, it's harder for me to live right when I'm around them. At the very least, that means that Satan is using them against me. And they love you. It ought to be easier to serve God around them. That'll make it easier to serve God. So if you're dating a person and it's harder to serve God with this person, that's symptomatic that this person is a church, it may be a church person, but they're not a Christian person will make it easier for you to serve the Lord. You know, in my marriage, and I've talked about this, I think it's not a perfect marriage. My wife will say, you know what? If I weren't married to you, I'd go to church a lot less. And she's been honest about that. We've had a conversation, and she said, I wouldn't be dragging the kids out on Sunday night, I'll tell you that. Like, well, good, you married me. Better chance you'll get to heaven then. Married me. I'm good for you. But on the other hand, my wife is a great balance for me because she has to tell me multiple times a year, be nice, be nice. And I'll describe a situation, and she said, well, just remember, there's no excuse for being rude. No excuse. And she says that because she knows me. There's no excuse for being rude. And so, you know, I'll have a discussion, or I'll have this, you know, maybe there's a bit of a conflict, and I'll go home, and what does she say when I come in? Were you rude? I got faced. Well, I tried not to be, you know. Well, what's that saying? That's saying that there's a high percentage chance that we're both believers. Because I think that, you know, Ephesians 5 talks about, likens Christ and the church to a husband and wife, and it talks about how the husband sanctifies the wife. There is a sense in which a husband is sanctifying a wife and a wife is sanctifying a husband. There is a sense in which you ought to be getting holier because you're together in this relationship, not more unholy. So again, first point, and I'll move more quickly on the other three, but I think that's the big one. Do you have similar values? And you have to be honest about that. Because I know they're good looking. I know he looks like Tom Selleck, but do you have similar values? You know, I know she's beautiful, but do you have similar values? Because again, you know, Bible says beauty is fleeting. You build it on that. It's a sort of a sandy way to build a marriage. It can get you to about 80, but after 80, you know, no, I'm joking. Maybe 90. I don't know. Secondly, you need to marry a person you can solve problems with. Solve problems with. Amos chapter 3:3 says, "Can two walk together unless they be agreed?" You know, life in general is just a series of problems to be solved. You got to figure out where you're going to live. You got to figure out what cars you're going to buy. You got to figure out how you're going to spend the money. Life is a series of decisions that you have to solve together. And so the question is can you solve problems together? I think James Dobson once said, in his opinion, that would be one of the top two or three things. You need to date each other long enough to see if you can solve problems together. So you say, how long should we date? Have you been together long enough that you've been in enough situations where you had to see whether or not you can solve issues together? And if you don't know that, you probably shouldn't marry that kind of person. Now again, that's why it's important to see how a person's other relationships work. Because if a person can't problem solve with other people, they probably can't problem solve with you either. I mean, again, and we've talked about this before, if their parents, if a person grows up in a functional household, now there's a lot of crazy parents in the world, so you got to give some kids a benefit of a doubt, because there's some crazy parents. But if you look at their parents and say, you know what, in all honesty, their parents are normal. You know, not perfect, but they're normal. If a person can't, if they're constantly in conflict with normal parents, that's really bad. Because the points of conflict shouldn't be that much. It shouldn't be a major problem to figure out when you're going to be home at night. Curfews are not a major problem. Privacy should not be a major problem. The parent has to know what goes on in the house. The kid needs a level of independence. There ought to be a solution to that if everybody's normal. The issues of growing up should not be rocket science. And if they can't somehow solve those problems, they're never going to be able to solve the problems that are going to come in marriage. And so that's a major, major issue. Jordan Peterson, I was watching him a couple months ago, I guess, and he said some really hard things. He's probably the most famous psychiatrist today. He said, in his opinion, the most important thing a parent does for their child is makes them likable. He said, because he said you have 4 to 5 years to make your child likable. Because when they go to school, if they're not likable, if they're a snot, if they haven't figured out how to play with kids, the rest of their life, they're going to look at people, read from people, is that they're not liked. So when they go to school, if you haven't made them likable where they can get along and function in a classroom and community, the rest of their life, all they're going to do is look around at a room full of people and see disapproving faces at them. He said, and that will harden them. He said, the statistics are astounding of kids who aren't adequately socialized by the age of 5 ending up in prison. He said, that's a major reason people end up in prison. They're spoiled. They haven't learned how to share. They haven't learned how to give and take. They go to school, and now for 13 years, nobody likes them because they haven't figured out how to function in society. He said, and all they see in their life are thousands of faces looking at them that don't like them. And it does something to them. It does something to them. It hardens them. That they're basically cast out of society. And well, that was a hard statement that he said. But I'm just being honest with you. You don't want to marry that person. You don't want to marry the person who never learned how to socialize, who never learned how to give and take, who never learned how to problem solve, who never learned how to work in polite society, who fought with their parents, fought with their brothers and sisters, fought in school, fights at their job, can't hold a job. Guess what? They're going to fight with you. You can problem solve or you can't. You better marry a person who can problem solve. Stephen Furtick, great preacher, said, too often we make decisions based on potential when we ought to look at patterns. Yeah, but what are the patterns in their life? You say they have so much ability. Have you seen patterns, not their potential? Then third, I'll move quickly, you need to marry a forgiving person. Marry a person that you have shared interest with. Marry a person who can solve problems. Marry a person who can forgive, because not only is life a series of problems to be solved, but it's a series of offenses to be forgiven. I mean, life is just full of opportunities to hold grudges. And so Ephesians 4:32 says, be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ forgave you. You can't live good enough to never need to be forgiven, particularly by a spouse. I mean, I'm not telling you wives anything you don't know. Maybe the husbands don't know this. You can't live in a house. It takes great grace to live with a man. Be greater grace to live with a woman, but that's there. But it takes great grace to live with a man. And again, you can either problem solve or you can't. You're either for a forgiving person or you're not too. Don't marry an unforgiving person. By the way, how do you know a person's a forgiving person? You know, how do you know that the pattern is there? Well, I would say this, a forgiving person, at the root of forgiveness is humility. Because, you know, Hebrews will talk about how the root of bitterness will keep springing up. And so, you know, the problem in life is you forgive them until you see their vacation pictures and then the root springs up. Yes, blast it. You know, and the envy keeps coming back. The way you forgive completely in the Bible, identify with the person who wronged you. You know, and Jesus will talk about debts being forgiven and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. The way you forgive other people's debts is you remember you're a debtor. You know, he owed the king a lot and somebody owed him a lot, but he forgot about it, so he didn't forgive the person who owed him a little, you know. Forgiving person, you have to be able to identify with them. You have to be able to say, either I've done that before, or in similar situations, I could have done that. That's how you forgive people. You say, you know, what they did to me, you know, is one thing, but I've done much worse to others. Or you can say, you know, the stuff that they did, I could see how I might have done the same thing if I was thinking what they were thinking. You're able to identify with them. So when you're around a person and you say, you know what, because, you know, dating's a funny thing. You're always putting on your best face, you know, generally, and so you're hiding a lot. But you're listening for qualities. You're listening for statements where they say, you know, like, I wrote some down here. It's a good sign when they say, you know, they haven't been a very good friend to me. But then again, I haven't always been the friend I should be either. That's a great sign you're talking about a forgiving person because they can identify. Or if they say, you know, the things they said were very hurtful to me. But then again, I'm sure that I've been hurtful to a lot of other people in my life too. Shows you can identify. My parents weren't probably very good parents, but if I had been raised like them, I'd probably be worse than they were. I think they did pretty good given what they went through. If I'd have gone through it, you know, I wouldn't have done as good as they did. That's a sign that you can identify with it. That's a sign that you have a forgiving heart. You know, you say they really disappointed me. But then again, there are people who would say that I've disappointed them. True forgiveness requires that I be able to identify with them and say, you know what, as bad as they've done, I'm sure I've done worse in my life. They weren't nice to me, but been people I haven't been nice to either, you know. That's what you're looking for in a mate. That means they get forgiveness. It means they understand it. It means that they have a spiritual gifting to forgive you. And if you see that pattern in their life, I think you can probably trust them in a marriage. If they don't get that, if they forgive you today, the next fight, when they're really mad, they're going to bring it back. Oh, Karen turned me off. Okay. And then fourth, very quickly, you need to marry a happy person. Marry somebody that you have shared values with. Say, you know what? Issues of children, issues of what we think about Jesus, issues of career, those kinds of things, we're pretty close on. Pretty shared value. We have shared values. And this is a mature person. They can problem solve. They're not in conflict with a lot of people. When they do, they tend to be able to sort of work it out. So I have a confidence they can work it out with me. And they're a forgiving person, and they're going to have a lot to forgive being married to me. So I can trust them. That's a good sign because I know I'm not going to be easy to live with. And then fourth, marry a happy person. Bible talks about learning contentment. That's Philippians 4:11. They have a mic. Thank you.
Works for me.
Yeah.
Works for me. I think it's you, buddy. Hello?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Probably the best that you can be in life is 80% of the things working for you, like with mics. But at any given point, probably 20% of your life isn't working well. So you have to learn to focus on what's right. And that's the secret to contentment. I mean, in my life, you know, marriage is working well, the kids are working well, but the stock market, you know, the money is funny right now. And I got my health, but, you know, 80% is good, but 20% could be a lot better, you know. And so happy people learn to focus on what's right in life and what's not. And there, at any given point, if you're an unhappy person, it's because you focus on what's not right in your life. And you have to learn that. If you go on a vacation, it's not perfect. I've never been on a vacation that was perfect. You go on a vacation, I haven't flown in the last 3 years that a flight wasn't delayed. They didn't get my luggage to me till a day later, and went to Tetons. That stunk. I mean, there's always too many people today. I mean, even when you go to a lovely place, if you're a grouchy person, there's enough to grouch about. And so at any given point in life, nothing's going to be perfect. There's always going to be problems. Everything in your life isn't going to be running at the same time. About the time you have enough money, you're going to have an idiot kid. And about the time everything's going right in your family, the house is going to fall apart. You know, you're going to have to replace the roof and the air conditioning all in the same month. That's life. That's life. And a happy person is able to focus on what's going right in life. And an unhappy person is a person who always sees the problem. And if you marry a person who's unhappy, it's because they haven't embraced the gift of singleness. They're looking at their life, and all they can see is the miserable. So when you marry them, guess what they're going to see about you? Everything that's not right about you. Everything that's wrong. Boy, you know, you'd think that we could live in a better house by at this point in our life. You would think that we, you know, I'm still driving a Corolla. And everybody, you know, marry a happy person. And don't be proud enough to say, you know what, she's unhappy, but man, having me for a husband will make her happy. It's not the way it's going to be. Not the way it's going to be. Gonna help. I think it may go worse. And so those being single is great. Paul says it's less complicated. You can be single and, you know, survive. If you don't burn, stay single, man. Stay single. But marriage is good. But marry somebody with similar values. Marry somebody who can problem solve. And again, if they can't, problems, this is Jordan Peterson, if they can't problem solve by their teens, don't assume they'll ever learn how to problem solve. Now, that's psychiatry. That's not God, because God can change a heart. God can make a difference. But when you're thinking about signing your life away, look at psychology too. You can do it or they can't. They're a forgiving person or they're not. They're a happy person or they're not. If you find a happy person, you've dated them long enough to know that they're a genuinely forgiving person. You've dated them long enough to end up with enough problems and you've been able to solve the problems. They're good at it. And you have common interest. Don't let him get away. Go ahead and marry him. Put a ring on it. All right, put a ring on it. All right. God bless you.